Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. In 2002, before U.S. forces rolled north to Baghdad, Andrew Bacevich, a professor of history and international relations at Boston University, warned that the Bush administration's grand scheme to remake the Arab world represented a tremendous risk. Back then, he wrote this about the impending war.
If this grand counteroffensive succeeds, Americans will have eliminated a dangerous threat to their way of life. But if the effort encounters greater resistance than its architects imagine, that way of life may find itself tested in ways that will make the Vietnam War look like a mere blip in American history.
The American occupation of Iraq eliminated a dictator, but it exacted a heavy toll on the people who lived there, the soldiers who fought there, including Andrew Bacevich's son, an infantry officer who was killed in Iraq. Andrew Bacevich has spent 16 years here at BU. Next month, he's stepping down from full-time teaching. He's a graduate of West Point with 23 years in the military, including service in Vietnam. And he's the author of a half dozen books, has a lot to say about the power of the U.S. abroad and about the limits of that power. And Andrew Bacevich, welcome back to Radio Boston. It's wonderful to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
And congratulations on this milestone in your life and career.
Thank you very much for that, too.
So here we are, 11 years after the American invasion of Iraq, and we're seeing the country gripped by civil war, essentially partitioned, with rebel fighters sweeping toward the Tigris, some of them driving U.S. armored vehicles. Is this the kind of outcome you were worried about back in 2002?
Well, I wish I could say that I saw the future that clearly. I think what I felt, to the best I can recall, what I felt back in 2002 was a sense of danger that the aspirations of the Bush administration were so vast that almost inevitably we would overreach, encounter obstacles that we were not prepared for, and therefore that the sort of lazy predictions of easy victory would simply not come to pass.
Mm. Well, let's listen to a bit of tape from those days. This is from 2003, from then President George W. Bush talking about American goals in Iraq. He was speaking at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute at the end of February 2003, a month before the American tanks started rolling toward Baghdad.
A liberated Iraq can show the power of freedom to transform that vital region by bringing hope and progress into the lives of millions. America's interests in security and America's belief in liberty both lead in the same direction, to a free and peaceful Iraq.
Now, Andrew Bacevich, we wanted to play that tape not to pile on, but to sort of illustrate the tone of the national conversation at the time. What do you hear today when you listen back to that tape?
Well, my sense of President Bush is that he is a person of somewhat limited abilities who in many respects was not prepared for the office that he was thrust into, thanks to the Supreme Court, and also not prepared for 9/11 and its aftermath, and who would have been to sort of take on board this shock, explain to the American people what it meant, and now explain what needed to be done. So my sense is that this somewhat limited man, limited in an intellectual sense, searched for a vocabulary or a line of reasoning that would help him fulfill this responsibility to explain to us what this was all about. And what he found was this language of American exceptionalism, this claim going back to the earliest days, not simply of our nation, but to the earliest days of Anglo-America, a claim that we are the chosen people, that we have a mission, a responsibility to the larger world. We are called upon to liberate, and by implication, we are called upon to remake the world in our image. Now, he spoke when the memories of 9/11 were still fresh, but the somewhat broader context is that he spoke in the wake of the Cold War. Remember that the end of the Cold War seemed to render this great historic verdict that liberal democratic capitalism was the only way to go, that there was no alternative. And I think that that historical moment, or the moment of the 90s, gave that much more force to this renewed claim of the American mission toward the rest of the world.
Hmm. You know, the last time I talked to you, it was about a collection of essays that you edited called The Short American Century, A Postmortem. And you talked then about what you just made reference to, a sort of mythology, almost a delusion about the realities that America sort of absorbed in the wake of the Second World War and its role in the, about its role in the world. And I'm wondering, as you look out today, are we still suffering from those delusions, those ideas, that sort of, I don't know, that misplaced idea about American exceptionalism? Have we learned anything from Iraq?
Well, at this specific moment, it would seem that the majority of the American people are not likely to be responsive to a call for a new crusade. My guess is, let's wait 10 years, and the bad memories of Iraq will pass, as did the bad memories of Vietnam, and once again, a public figure who reintroduces the vocabulary of American exceptionalism probably will find a responsive audience. The problem, it seems to me, is that, and this gets to the question of learning, the problem is that we don't have an alternative narrative that has any sort of popular purchase. Now, if not American exceptionalism, then what? Who are we? How are we to define ourselves if not in terms of this universal mission to liberate the world? And our politics and our intellectual tradition has not, it seems to me, yielded that alternative in a way that a separate identity that somehow can have some gain some political traction.
And why is that? You know, I'm so interested about this point because what I want, you mentioned this, Vietnam, Korea, Vietnam, then Iraq. Why does it seem, I mean, okay, so there isn't this alternative narrative about American exceptionalism, but there is this awful experience of these quagmires that seem to bog us down every generation or two. And yet,
well,
we don't learn.
Good question, and there's no easy answer. I think two parts of an answer might be the following. Number one is we are just so darn big. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are a parochial people. We are a provincial people. And the reason I think we are parochial and provincial is because we exist at some distance to much of the rest of the world, and we have so much here. And therefore, there's no requirement, really, to be attuned to the rest of the world in the way, for example, that Europeans know that they must be attuned to the rest of the world. And then the second thing, I think, is the overhang of World War II as the experience which still shapes our collective worldview in tremendously powerful ways. And it's not that World War II is not important, obviously, but it is the, in terms of the lessons of history that matter, are the lessons of World War II, the lessons of Munich, the lessons of Auschwitz. And those are tremendously important lessons that deserve to be attended to. It's just that they're not the only ones.
Mm-hmm.
And other lessons, for example, the lessons of Vietnam, simply don't have the same sort of stature.
I'm wondering what, I wanted to ask you a little bit about sort of the debate that's almost remarkably reigniting in Washington among the conservative hawks around what the U.S. should do in places like Syria and places like Iraq. Most recently, as you know, Robert Kagan, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, advisor to Senator McCain, Mitt Romney, Hillary Clinton, and he wrote in the New Republic that superpowers don't get to retire. What our tired country still owes the world, and he calls for America to return to muscular global activism. You responded to Kagan with a piece of your own, with a reference to something that you referred to as the duplicity of the ideologues. What did you mean by that? What is the duplicity of the ideologues?
Well, I think any fair-minded reading of Robert Kagan's essay, and it does deserve to be read, I think, because it's an interesting artifact, I think. Any fair reading of that would suggest that it's an exceedingly selective interpretation of our history. Making vast claims of this so-called world order that he claims we constructed in the wake of World War II, and of the what he calls the global responsibility that we exercised during that period of time. And what I try to lay out in my piece is, well, yeah, then how about all these other episodes, events, tragedies that somehow don't qualify for inclusion in his narrative? And I think that's the duplicity. That's one of the problems with the exponents of American we live in a wonderful, wonderful country. As Americans, we are privileged to be Americans. But that's no excuse for whitewashing our history or for rendering a distorted account that may make us feel good about ourselves, but actually end up causing us to not understand ourselves going forward.
Well, getting back to this idea, and it all seems tied into this idea that what's the alternative narrative to American exceptionalism? It seems like as Americans, we have a really hard time embracing, I don't know, I mean, what's the alternative narrative? The alternative narrative is limitations, humility, modesty, pulling back, living within our means. This all sort of runs counter to this idea that we can do anything.
Well,
we're Americans.
And of course, I like words like that, modesty and pragmatism and realism. But I would argue that perhaps it's possible to find a hook for an alternative narrative in an America that does, in some sense, have a mission, but that fulfills that mission by being an exemplar rather than by being the military superpower that is going to shove liberty down your throat whether you like it or not. If we could demonstrate that the values that we profess to believe in not simply work here in at home and yield a society in which justice and fairness and equitability and freedom can prevail, but also offer that as a model on which others could potentially draw, not to mirror us, not to imitate us, but to draw selectively. That, it seems to me, could be at least a basis around which to constitute a different approach to dealing with the rest of the world. Mm. Now, to get there, of course, means we'd have to so extricate ourselves from our military commitments that it would be a very difficult task to accomplish.
A difficult task, but a really profound challenge on the table here on the eve of the 4th of July holiday. Andrew Bacevich, he spent 16 years a professor here at Boston University. He'll continue to give special lectures. He'll continue to live in New England, I understand.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being here today, and happy 4th of July.
Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.